We will have a look at liberty tomorrow. It's a big and important question. And tonight is usually the... well, last year we made the evening session was usually a discussion, or guess who ended up doing most of the talking. But anyway, there was more freedom for feedback in the evening, so... So if you'd like to fire off some questions, you're very welcome. Let me just read you, for instance, though I have got also, you know, for the Unabomber. It's an interesting question. It's actually an interesting question. We could look at that. But in the meantime, just let me give you the... Here's Maliki Martin on the effect of the computer inside the modern church. McGregor threw open the door to his study and made for a row of file cabinets. Quote, here, Father Chris, look at the new gospel we bishops live by these days. Take a gander at what pastoral care looks like. Unquote. With every word he spoke, Bishop McGregor piled up papers. He stacked up printouts filled with electronic type and images. Quote, we live by polls and graphs and charts and statistical reports and bean counter assessments. We get psychosexual profiles and pie charts of drug and alcohol abuse. We get analytical tables and bar graphs of all the social ills you can name. We get this stuff every day from liturgical committees, from sacramental committees, from committees for women and committees for children, and environmental committees and population committees and economic policy committees. It comes at us from committees at the parish level, from diocesan and archdiocesan levels, and from the regional and national conferences of bishops. In fact, we get so much of this garbage and our minds are so stuffed with it that it actually changes the way we think. You've come here for the truth, Chris. And Bishop McGregor turned from the files at last. Quote, and for my money, the truth is that life and thought and faith itself are becoming digitalized. We're all barreling down the same info barn the way gold grubbers thronged to Sutter's Mill. That's Sacramento, California. But gold isn't the big attraction now. Even the best bishops I know are being enticed down that highway by one word that sparkles and gleams at every turn. Digital. More and more, the information we rely on to run our dioceses and our parishes comes from a computer network that fuses everything into one mode. Religion and the morality based on that religion are being reduced to endless streams of zeros and ones. And something in that process, or maybe something about the way it's being used, is stripping supernatural meaning away from facts, the way our good Kansas corn is stripped from cobs. The single word digital is like one of those computer viruses we hear about that travel around the world like lightning, wiping out whole storehouses of information. Only this virus, digital, is wiping out the whole vocabulary of faith. It's transforming Roman Catholicism from a religion that must hear to the truth or die into a culture that must change with the world or be left behind. Now, clearly, the fault is with the men. I mean, these new churchmen are just looking for an excuse to go with the world. And the computers and the printouts and the mice are giving them that excuse. So, nevertheless, these machines are the excuse for all kinds of people today to get away from people and into
isolation.
Zeros and ones that I completely dominate by punching my buttons. The magic lantern, we're back to the magic lantern. And it's a magic lantern that I completely control. It doesn't even do something on the floor like the dog every now and again does. There's never any spontaneity coming out of the machine. It's all totally predictable. Totally under my control.
There's a lot of statistics coming out, but now we think we must do something to them or with them. And
the printouts, people, salvation by printouts. And the papers pile up any amount of information, masses and masses of information. And the internet, That's wonderful. I can get all kinds of books on the internet. So I just do, and the books pile up. Do I ever read the books? Are the books any the better or any the worse for being printable out on the internet? It's just the medium is the message, as Marshall McLuhan said. The medium is the message. That was the famous saying of Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan was not a saint, but the medium is the message. The famous saint. Marshall McLuhan was a naughty man. He was an American thinker in the around the 1960s. And what he meant by that is that the machine becomes an end in itself. The medium is the message. It's the simple fact of printouts which is what matters, not what's being printed out or how valuable is what's being printed out. You could be printing garbage or you could be printing wonderful things. It doesn't matter, it's just being printed out. And here am I sitting in my controls and punching buttons, and I'm controlling this whole process, and I'm getting stacks of printout, and that's great, regardless of what's being printed out. So the computer, the computer, not in the sense of the little thing inside my watch or the little thing inside the radio, but the computer as, you know, what sits on the desk. The computer is a tremendous turner of means into ends. In other words, it's a tremendous destroyer of ends. It's an intrinsic underminer or devaluer of ends. But means have no purpose except an end. Now, it's the fault of the human beings. And wisely used, these printouts can be very good. But if you get foolish human beings, and the foolish churchmen misusing all of these computers, and filling the chancelleries and the rectories with printouts. Obviously, it's their fault principally. But these machines, which are only tools, become the purpose of life. They tend to make themselves into a purpose. All right.
Okay. Those are all fair analogies from a point of view. I, for the most part, agree with you.
Okay.
Except, just like restroom has nothing to do with resting.
Go on.
The computer has been associated with everything that we cannot explain. I will bet there is less than 1/10 of 1% of the people who deal with computers who even know that the ones and zeros that make up that information is printed by that tool. The only reason ones and zeros are used is as a vehicle to explain the ununderstood. Since we don't understand it, we use this simple thing, well, a computer did, so it must be right. It's ones and zeros, nobody knows this. That's not true. It's just an easy way out. It's an escape mechanism, and it's as real as our lounge or restroom is.
I'm not sure I follow your main answer.
I recognize everybody uses the term computer for computer-assisted products.
Yes.
But that has nothing to do with the product it's producing.
Well,
the people are being very... If I'm an organization and I want to influence you, I will give you as much influence as possible, whether it's statistics, whether it's surveys, or whatever. And if I need to prove to you it's valid, I will tell you it's computer generated so that you won't fight it. Because the average person simply doesn't understand it, therefore they blindly accept it.
Yes, okay.
And it's a tool misused so as to push other tools that are misrepresented
yes.
Facts.
Yeah.
Everyone yes. Has known that statistics don't lie, but every liar knows statistics.
Yes. Well, yes, I think what you're saying is that computers are the latest instrument of oppression by people who know of people who don't know. In other words, it's a weapon. Computers have been turned into a weapon whereby some people oppress and exploit other people.
But
right?
Let's go back several centuries when reading and writing was only a skill by the religious educators, because they had the time, they took the time to do so, and that's how things were passed out. Therefore, they become the controlling influence. Everybody knows how to read and write now. If you run across somebody who doesn't know how to read and write, you say, oh, my poor person, you must be lost. How do you survive in today's world? Computers are now introduced, and they're taking that
I'm
lost.
But the point, what you're saying is that computers, just by the fact that not everybody understands how they work, turn into a substitute for the content. In other words, instead of saying this is true because it's true, you say this is true because the computer says it. In other words, the computer is becoming the message. The value of the message lies in the fact that it's coming from the computer.
Authenticity.
Okay. Well.
Therefore, you cannot argue it.
Yeah. Okay.
Whether it's real or unreal.
Well, I mean, what you're arguing on my side, you're saying that the computer is intrinsically lending itself.
Using the word computer.
Oh.
If it's a shit house, that's called a shit house, and that's not called a computer.
Yeah. Right. But the main point is that. These machines are treated as solutions in themselves, whereas, as you're saying, in fact, they become simply part of the human problem. They get meshed into they become part of oppression and exploitation, just like everything else. In other words, the bottom line is still and always human beings. But a lot of these modern machines fool people into thinking that the bottom line is not human beings. The bottom line is human beings. It's always human beings and God. That's the bottom line, and the angels. The bottom line is not machines, but these machines block people's view and prevent them from seeing what really matters.
I also agree that this statement about the medium is the message. Is a very similar parallel. If you come to anyone in charge with a problem, it is quite often the messenger who gets shot, not the problem observer.
But it is
the computer providing the message, it's carrying the authenticity and reliability, and we are not yet equipped to deal with reality.
Yeah, the reality is the real questions are ultimately always.
So the messenger has become our authority.
The real questions are always human questions, and these machines disguise that fact.
No,
yes.
I think these machines become inhuman simply because of the bigness of what they can do.
The machines,
and
machines.
From a human perspective, and nobody can check anymore.
Sorry. I beg your pardon. Machines are not inhuman simply because of their bigness or their size. Machines are inhuman because there is no way in which any machine can have free will. I was saying, even a dog has something that, and no machine, any dog, any animal has something that no machine has. When I've got a tiny little ant, one of those tiny on the end of my finger, I don't know which way it's going to walk. Only God knows which way it's going to walk. There's no mechanical program. Whereas if I've got a computer in front of me, every single move of that computer is predictable, except for something that breaks down. But short of a breakdown, every single thing is predictable. It's going along fixed grooves. Therefore, it is intrinsically inhuman. And to reduce all human problems, or any human problems, to mechanical terms, is to cut out what's essentially human. And it's to contribute to a process of mechanizing and dehumanizing human beings. You're killing off what's essentially human in human beings. Listen to the Unabomber's argument, because he's got quite a bit to say on this question. Here is a summary. This is just a brief summary of the Unabomber, and we'll go into it a little more. This does actually bear on the encyclicals, because the form that this... I should need another... I haven't left myself one.
Can you share?
Okay, thanks very much. I'll share, okay. I'm sorry about that. Okay. The summary starts on the bottom of page one. And it runs on the bottom of page one, it runs down most of page two. It's in 7 points. This is a very, very brief summary of the Unabomber's Manifesto, which is 100 pages in a paperback. That's the manifesto, okay? So it's quite thick. That's 100 paperback pages. And he says it's already too short. So he considers he's got a big argument, and I think he has. I don't think he's infallible, and I don't think he's a saint, but I do think he's interesting, and I do think he's got a point. Let's just read the very, very brief summary. Modern society, this is two paragraphs from the bottom of page one of this letter. Modern society is destroying human dignity and freedom by its industrial technology. Machines are dehumanizing. A symptom of this destruction is the modern left-winger or leftist, a type of man recurring in numerous protest movements today, often himself belonging to no minority group. In other words, he's not a black, he's not even a woman, he's not a lesbian, he's not a Jew or anything like that. He's a WASP, but nevertheless, in the name of a variety of such groups, he attacks Western civilization with a hostility, betraying his lack of real compassion for the supposed victims. In other words, your leftist pretends to be sympathizing with Jews and blacks or homosexuals or whatever, and he's not real. These things are all an instrument to get at Western civilization. Why does he want to get at Western civilization? The Unabomber doesn't know. You and I know. Because Western civilization betrayed God a long way back up here. And what the Unabomber in paragraph one is in fact observing, he doesn't understand, because he's not the faith. He doesn't understand what's going on, but what he's in fact observing is the globe turning against people. In other words, baby seals, hug a tree, and the ozone layer being used. Actually, it's still the blacks and the Jews being used, or the handicapped, or all of the minority groups are being used as a lever to destroy what still remains of Christian civilization. Because your leftist says this layer is no good. And he's right, to quite an extent. Because this layer is a long way down from the Catholic Church. And it represents several betrayals that have already taken place. So your leftist is attacking, well, what is he attacking in the name of? He can't attack in the name of the king, because that's tyranny. He can't attack in the name of the aristocracy, because that's elitism. He can't attack in the name of the middle class, because that's capitalism. So he's got to attack in the name of trees, baby seals, and those of them. And or blacks and Jews. So he's right down here. That's what your leftist is in fact doing. The Unabomber can't see that. But he doesn't belong to a minority group, but your leftist, says Kaczynski, goes through this false association with minority groups as a means of getting back at quote-unquote Western civilization. And he does it with a hostility which betrays that he's not really interested or sympathetic with blacks, Jews, and homosexuals. He really wants to destroy what remains of Western civilization. Nor can his revolt be so real against society when he wishes to integrate them into it. That's another... The man's smart. See? Because he wants blacks. He's saying blacks are scorned and trodden on and walked all over. We want blacks back into society. Hey, I thought you said society was no good. But why do you want to pull blacks into it then? So you see, he's picking up the contradiction which there are in these left-wingers. He's saying leftists are junk. He's right. And he says that's a symptom. Leftists are then a major... The malady of leftism is a symptom of the sickness of modern society. And he's going to blame the sickness of modern society on industrial technology. In truth, point two, the industrial technological system, IT, or IT for short, makes it so easy for men to satisfy their basic needs of food, clothing, and shelter, that man's equally natural need to attain some goal by serious effort on his own part, remains widely frustrated. He's right again. In the old days, you didn't have kids wandering all over the streets and getting frustrated and drive-by shooting and visiting rotten cinemas and getting you didn't have that in the old days. Because the boys had to work on the land, because if they didn't work on the land, then their mother would starve in February or March. The hard grind and discipline of farm work meant the boys just didn't get mixed up, and the girls didn't get mixed up either. The girls had no washing machines, so they had to stay home and make the farmhouse turn, wash all the men's clothes when the men were out working all day in the fields. Therefore, there was an interaction and a necessity and a harsh grind of life which stopped them getting all out of shape. There's a very amusing thing said about Jewish immigrants. They used to land in Brooklyn, and then, of course, they moved inland to sort of the posh parts of New Jersey. And the Jew is quoted in New Jersey as saying, you know, when we landed from the old world in Brooklyn, we were far too miserable to think of committing suicide. That's it. But now that we're rich and idle and leisured in New Jersey, and we've got beautiful homes, we all think of committing suicide. As long as we were miserable, we were quite happy. Now that we're completely happy, we're all miserable. That's it. And that's what the Unabom is saying. He's saying that a man doesn't only need food and clothing and so on. He also needs to do something with purpose in his life, to feel that he's got a contribution to make, to feel that what he's doing counts. And that what he's doing counts tends to be destroyed by the huge combine harvesters, which with a jaw as wide as this room go through one field in a few hours and feed the whole village for the whole winter. There's a trade-off for these magnificent machines. And it's all very well having a magnificent combine harvester which will feed the village for the whole winter in a few hours, but the trade-off is that the boys are going to be, you're going to create welfare bums. If you didn't have huge harvesters, you couldn't have welfare bums, because the welfare bums would all be out picking cotton. They'd have to be, because they have to make a living and put food on the table. So the trade-off of these huge machines is a leisure which a lot of people don't know how to use, and actually the destruction of a lot of people's sense of their own value. Because I don't have to work for my living. I get green stamps and welfare. It's all done for me.
And it's not that they mustn't work, but they cannot work for a living because they're not jobs. There's a book out recently.
He says the same thing. Also, family. Or any such small-scale loyalty natural to man. And he means then the local village. Man, that the Unabomber realizes that man naturally lives in little communities. He lives in a family, then the family lives on a block, and the block is part of a village or is part of a street. And the Unabomber realizes that men need that. But he says, any such small-scale loyalty is necessarily disrupted by the large-scale commitment required for industrial technology to function. It's very smart. Let's stop and think for a moment. Here I've got a factory mass producing, I think this is his example, mass producing, let's say, shoes. And because I produce so many of them, I produce them very cheaply. But if I produce in Cleveland, Ohio, a massive amount of shoes, I've got to get them out to all parts of the country. In other words, there's got to be distribution. For the shoes to be produced so cheaply, the lorry driver, the truck drivers have got to get them out. The truck drivers mustn't go on strike. The truck drivers have got to be in sync with the factory. And then the retailers have got to be in sync with the truck drivers, in sync with the factory. The huge scale production requires the smooth running of a huge machine. Therefore, he says, that's what he means by the large scale commitment. Industrial technology requires a large-scale commitment in order to work. He says one refrigerator requires steel, it requires Freon, a factory producing Freon or something like it. It requires somebody to get it, to move it across the country. It requires a whole lot of things that you don't think of when the refrigerator is just standing there. But behind one refrigerator stands a whole system A whole wide scale and big system, all of which is necessary for one refrigerator to operate. Added to which, of course, the whole, you need a whole local electric power station. Yeah, industrial technology destroys family values. Because you have to put loyalty to the big system over loyalty to my little village. Otherwise, the big system is just not going to work. And therefore, the big system is at war with the little systems. And if you put all your faith and money into the big systems, it's going to necessarily destroy the little systems. So, when people say, we want the family, we want family values, we want the family, we want family values, and then in the next breath say, but we want mass-produced goods, which are all very cheap, so that we have a nice, soft, comfortable way of life. The Unabomber says, such people are contradicting themselves without realizing it. They are wanting a whole lot of things which undermine what on the other side they also think they want. And so the whole system of American life, for instance, tends to the destruction of the family. So that when poor Americans stand up and say, I want to defend my family, I believe in family values, I want to defend my family, nearly always the same Americans, 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 15 minutes later, will be speaking up for technology or speaking up for industry or speaking up for something which undermines the very family that they just said that they wanted to defend. So there is always a trade-off. And the trade-off of industrial technology is expensive. Exactly the same things happening in Europe. In Europe, decent Englishmen are saying, we want England. Decent Germans, patriotic Germans are saying, we want the sovereignty of Germany. Decent Frenchmen are saying, we want old-fashioned Catholic France. But a quarter of an hour later, that same Englishman, the same German, and the same Frenchman are all saying, but we also want the nice life which is provided by European-scale production. But the moment you speak up for European scale production, so that the shoes come from Spain, the tomatoes come from Italy, the razors come from Holland, the beef comes from England, whatever it is, the moment you want wide scale production, with all the bananas coming from Ireland, whatever it may be, you've necessarily got to put Europe first. And so these dear Europeans who... The dear Europeans, who on the one hand want to defend their own country, on the other hand want the soft, inexpensive and easy life, they're contradicting themselves without realizing it. If you want a nice sovereign country, you've got to pay the price, which is less manufactured, soft, inexpensive goods. If you want these soft, inexpensive, easily available, mass-produced goods, you've got to say sooner or later, bye-bye to national sovereignty. Take your pick. You pay your money, you take your choice, but you can't have it both ways. Okay. The Unabomber sees it, and he's a smart man. And he says, you can't have both industrial technology, nationwide industrial technology, and the family. You can't have it both ways. You're going to have to take your pick. Therefore, it destroys family values. Similarly, the host of rules and regulations imposed by the functioning of industrial technology stifle man's acting on his own part to attain real goals, which is what the Unabomber says is his real freedom. And therefore, according to the Unabomber, not only is industrial technology against the family, industrial technology is also against liberty. He's got this liberty bug, but there's something in it. Three. Nor can any minor adjustment or compromise reconcile industrial technology with freedom. Both because industrial technology has to regulate human behavior closely in order to function at all, and because all parts of industrial technology are interdependent. That's something he proves in detail. Take, for example, a steel mill. As you know, a steel mill has to keep hot all the time. It takes a long time to heat up a steel oven. And once you've got it hot, you have to keep it moving. In other words, you're going to have workers all around the clock. For workers to work the first shift, you're going to have workers on the second shift. You'll have to have workers on the third shift. And if one of the shift workers drops out, the oven cools off and the other shift workers are all in trouble. You have to step into the system and make part of the system and obey the system for the system to operate. Whereas when you're running your own little farm with your own little horses, independent of anybody else's farm, you don't have to worry about what anybody else is doing on their farm. The working unit is just your little farm. The working unit, at the very most, your little village. But industrial technology means that your working unit is either the whole country or the whole continent. And in Europe, it's getting dramatic. Because the national sovereignties of these famous old nations is going under, and it's going under the wheels of the juggernaut of industrial technology. Let's wait until the end, but I must lay out what the Unabomber thinks, and then we'll be wide open. All parts of IT are interdependent. For instance, the refrigerator manufacturers absolutely require electricity, and the electricity absolutely requires somebody to produce machines which need the electricity. The whole thing interlocks. On a massive scale, the whole thing has to interlock. You can't deny it. You just can't deny it. And there's always a trade-off. But if you have the nationwide technology, there's a serious loss as far as the family is concerned. And he argues why. He argues. The man thinks. Moreover, men's desire for industrial technology and for the benefits of industrial technology has for a long time been proving stronger than their desire for freedom for a variety of reasons. So that the advance of industrial technology seems to many people to be irreversible. I'm sure it seems to many of you to be irreversible. For instance, interesting example. The use of a motor car was originally optional. When motor cars first arrived, you could have one or you could not have one. You didn't have to have one. But then, after a while that the motor cars had been here, especially in the United States, the cities were laid out in function of the motor car. The suburbs immediately began spreading out much wider. And in order to go to the shops, you need a motor car. In the old-fashioned towns and villages, like in New England, you can walk to the shops, you could walk to the shops. But no longer. Today, the mall is 5 or 10 minutes away in a motor car. And everybody thinks nothing of jumping into the motor car and driving to the mall to buy. But you need a motor car to get to the mall. Sometimes they often don't even have pavements or walkways any longer to get from the suburbs or the homes to the shopping malls. And if you walk from your home to the shopping mall, the police car comes by to ask what you're doing. Because you're a strange creature if you're still on your 2 feet. In other words, originally the use of a motor car was optional, but the motor car, the very motor car, so changed the layout of cities that now you have to have a motor car. Therefore, he argues, industrial technology will be stopped by no small-scale reform, but only wholesale revolution. So he's wanting another revolution to break up the industrial technology establishment. Admit, the man's got some brains. 4. The clash between industrial survives, whichever way, man will have to be re-engineered beyond all recognition. In other words, it's either IT or man. Take your pick. That's what he's arguing. It's a strong argument. 6. However, IT is not unstoppable. We can throw a monkey wrench in the works. The positive alternative that we need, is wild nature. This is why he went off to live in a cabin in Montana. Free of men or with wild men. So he's back to destroying human beings. He's got no answer. He's got no real answer. He sees the problem. He's very good at the problem. But without the faith, he's got no idea of how to put it together again or how to get out of it. So his answer is logical. Since industrial technology is the problem, then we've got to go back to the wilds. And he had that little cabin in the middle of Montana, in the middle of nowhere. What's the advantage of wild nature? It's completely non-technological, adders and ferns and bushes and rivers and streams and mountains and clouds. It's non-technology, it's beautiful, it takes care of itself, it permits survival living. One may have toothaches, but rather toothaches are better than industrial technology. The means of overthrowing IT are a revolution which will be not merely political, but economic, technological, and worldwide, because IT cannot be overthrown piecemeal. So he's dreaming of a massive worldwide uprising against the machine. Above all, let our revolutionaries, so he wants another revolution. We've had 1, 2, 3, 4, so he wants a fifth revolution. It's all the same thing. Because IT cannot be overthrown piecemeal. Above all, let our revolutionists have the one clear goal, IT must go, IT must go, IT must go. All means to achieve that goal can then be pragmatically adjusted. And he talks like Lenin, you know, he talks like a communist. And he says, we need a revolution, and the revolution will, the revolutionaries need to fix on the goal and then adapt all the means. That's exactly what Lenin used to say. 7, finally. Let our revolutionaries not mix with leftists who are as anti-individualist as IT is. And so the leftists will only oppose IT in order then to use it against everybody else. He knows leftists inside out. And so he hates industrial technology, and then he hates leftists, and he wants to go back to wild nature. It's just another non-solution, in fact. But he's right, as so often, all the way down, he's right about the defects of the previous establishment. Henry VIII was wrong, because Henry VIII was attacking the Catholic Church. But all of the others are more or less right in what they're attacking. Also, leftists habitually collaborate in revolutions with non-leftists, only to double-cross them later. Leftism is totalitarian by nature. In fact, it is a substitute religion, the need to believe in which will make even decent followers condone the most indecent crimes from their leaders. And so he started with the delinquency of leftism, and he finishes with the delinquency of leftism. So he knows that leftism is no answer. He's protesting against leftism. He's protesting against the socialists of FDR, the welfare socialists of FDR, and their welfare state, their industrial technological welfare state. And he's another stage down. Poor fellow, if only he could, you know, get back to the faith. Well, alright, now, what would anybody... That's a very brief summary of what the Unabomber says. Jim.
Did Karl Marx write his manifesto because of the Industrial Revolution in England?
He pretended that was really what it was about, yes.
Because he had spent some time there?
He didn't really, but you know, he made his case. Marx made his case for communism against the middle class. Marx was the workers against the middle class. That wasn't the United States. In the United States, it was F.D. Roosevelt against the middle class, right? Marx made his case on the basis of what he said was going on with industrialism in Great Britain, yes. And there were indeed abuses in Great Britain.
Well,
no question about it.
The exploitation.
No question about it. How does that connect with the
Well, it sounds like this is a Unabomber.
Yes.
Wrote his manifesto against the same kind of thing.
Not really, no. The Unabomber is one stage beyond Marx. Here we have, remember this morning, we have the middle class, and then we have the people, or the lower class. You're not allowed, it's politically incorrect today to talk about the lower class. So let's call them the people. And then we have the globe, which was baby seals, etc. equals wild nature. The Unabomber calls it wild nature. So really, the Unabomber is a globalist, reacting against the welfare state, the industrial technology, green stamp welfare state of the people. So the Unabomber is that. He's way down at the bottom of the line. But whereas Marx was this. This is Marx. Marx was this stage.
and the Unabomber is one stage on. That's why the Unabomber despises the leftists. It's the leftists who reacted against the middle class. These are leftists. And the Unabomber despises the leftists.
You would like to go back to the primitive man of Rousseau.
Yes. Perhaps even wilder than Rousseau, yes. Logically, he was living in that little cabin in Montana, if that's him, and it does look like it was him.
But he should be, not get condemned simply because he has written this beautiful thing. It's enough reason to not convict him. He's done a
service. Hey. You know, I mean, he killed 3 people and wounded another 20. He's got to answer for that. I'm absolutely not saying he hasn't got to answer for that. He's a criminal. But this is what's behind it. And, this doesn't justify his crimes, but it does tell you that the man is not a common criminal. The man is a highly intelligent, protester against a way of life which is indeed deeply anti-human. And the problem with these machines, modern man worships machines. And so, we were saying last night, how do people, do either the conservatives or the liberals go into the Unabomber's arguments? No. They won't touch it with a barge pole. Because both the right-wingers and the left-wingers absolutely believe in kicking away from the Catholic Church. They believe in materialistic comfort. And he's questioning that. He's questioning the very basis of modern life. The Unabomber is a heretic. As far as liberalism is concerned, he's an absolute heretic. He's questioning leftism, he's questioning liberalism, he's questioning materialism, he's questioning technology. All of these things that neither the average right-winger nor the average left-winger will dream of condemning. They all think that the modern way of life with machines instead of God is wonderful. He's not speaking up for God. Doesn't mention him. Hardly mentions him. But he is saying the machines are dead wrong. There's something seriously wrong with the machines. Machines are anti-human. That's what he's saying. He's right. The trade-off is too heavy.
This conference continues on the next MP3 track.
The machines do bring certain advantages, but the cost is too heavy. That's what he's saying. Surely he's right. Yes. Sorry?
No, we don't need a revolution. It will collapse anyway.
It's going to collapse under its own weight. That's what he sort of says. He says that, and the rock, in my opinion, the rock music and rock musicians, the youngsters are instinctively alienated from this modern society and this modern way of life. And that's what all of rock music is about. It's an alienation. And it expresses, rock music is essentially a revolt. Gay rock music is wanting to push down. There are very few Catholic rock musicians. Catholics don't go in for rock music. It's too ugly. And Catholics don't have ugliness in their songs. So the rock music is not a Catholic solution. But rock music is a protest, another protest against a system and a way of life which has got a lot that's wrong with it. And therefore, once more, when the rock musician, in what the rock musicians criticize, they're right. There's a lot that's true in what they criticize and the way in which they criticize it. But the problem with the rock musicians, they've got nothing to put in its place except drugs and sex and Satanism. And that's no solution. The Unabomber's answer is wild nature. And the rock musician's answer is drugs and impurity. Well, they're not solutions. But both of them have something very true. There's truth in what both of them say when they criticize the establishment that they're revolting against.
99% of the people are frustrated or resigned.
Yes. But they're not fulfilled. They're not living happy lives. They're living out of whack with the nature that God gave to them. They're in line, they're in whack with the Masonic world and the Masonic nature, but they're out of whack with God's nature. And that's, It's again this, it's this problem. Men are living against God's grain. And it can't fly. And it's, in one shape, size, or form, it's going to crash. It's got to come apart. He just said, you may remember, he said in the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are my numbers. It's got you don't find the original text divides up into 230 paragraphs, 232 paragraphs. So that this numbering is purely arbitrary of mine. But the argument sort of divides into seven sections. But he said there. There are more and more people arising up against industrial technology. Presently, more and more humans are rising up in revolt against industrial technology. But the youth have to be bribed into accepting it. And then when the youth stop listening to rock music and put on a dark suit and go off and start working on Wall Street like everybody else, some spark goes out. There's some life goes out of them. What a terrible thing to say. So long as the youth are still listening to rock music, there's hope. But the moment they stop listening to rock music and put on a dark suit and go off and become decent citizens, then the situation's hopeless.
Several months ago, you wrote about the mainstream of politics.
Yes.
And the kids and the rock music and the rock subculture is out of that mainstream.
Yes.
And when they give up the rock music, they become mainstream.
Yes, that's right.
And I think your epistle had something that we're not mainstream either. I guess we're on opposite bank of the river than the rock musicians.
Yes.
But they assimilate into the mainstream. And you see it, you know, we see it in Topeka with the wild hair news. And
yes.
You know, it's obvious, like, well, this kid's never going to get a job. But to get a job, they got to give up their wild hair news,
yes.
And their four earrings and
yes.
Their nose ring. And then,
yes.
You know, but then it's the mainstream.
That's right.
And eventually the mainstream would be a man broke and would not accommodate all those who want to become mainstream. And that's what would be the moment. It's here now. I only know an employed people, and not because I'm not worth it, but because I'm not trying hard, not because I didn't have a career.
It's... Anyway, these criticisms, what else has, if one stops and listens to some of the delinquents, real delinquents or supposed delinquents, protesting against modern society, like the Unabomber, or like the film director Oliver Stone, or like many rock musicians, for instance Pink Floyd, then without accepting that their ends justify all their means, one cannot help having a measure of understanding for their resorting to such desperate means. Modern man is in the more deadly trouble for having his ears blocked by a seemingly impenetrable complacency. People, this materialism just blocks human beings. It blocks their ears, it blocks their eyes, and they are just sunk into this materialism. And that's the state most people are in today. They're happily sleeping under layers and layers of thick, stodgy materialism. And how do you get through to people? How do you wake people up in this situation?
Only pain will wake
them up. It's going to take pain, yes. Quote, yes, but Catholic bishops have no business to be rummaging in such gutters. What on earth are you doing, quoting terrorists like the Unabomber, or talking as though terrorists have anything to say? It's an outrage that you're giving any credit to the Unabomber. Madam, do you wish to save your rebellious teenagers' souls? I'm sure that you're well aware that if you talk to your teenager about Ignatius of Loyola or Saint Therese of Lisieux, you do not even get to first base. But just breathe the name of Pink Floyd, and the youngsters immediately perk up. This is their world. This is what the youngsters are in tune with. The youngsters are alienated. You don't know why. You adults don't know why. This is why. This is our world, and there is no other in which we have to save our souls. If only the honorable professors and respectable bishops were tackling the questions tackled by the Unabombers and by the Oliver Stones, then your children might look up to the professors and the bishops instead of looking down to the rock musicians and the terrorists. But since nobody decent, quote-unquote, seems to address the concerns of these youngsters, how can you be surprised if they go and eat out of the gutter? You close the cafe and you close the restaurant, and then you're surprised when they go and eat in the gutter? Rock music is one long, unheard scream for help. Well, I don't know if that seems to be fairly outrageous. This is the world that Masonry is producing. Materialism, salvation by machines. You've got a problem? Invent a new machine. Invent a new pill. How many know Aldous Huxley's Brave New World? Soma, you know, you just give people pills. We've already got that pill retinol which they give to kids. And now you get, you know, the problem, if the kids have a problem, hey, think, why have they got a problem? No. Our society is wonderful. All we need to do is give them some drug, and then they will accept that our society is wonderful. You turn them into zombies with your drugs, and then you will have a wonderful society full of zombies. Well, that's what people today think. Any other questions about anything that's come up today? Yes.
I want to backtrack all the way to the start of number one, and we were walking through lots of these examples and counterexamples, and so I took some notes. Hopefully, right here. You talked about the negative big machine, and you used an example of the combine machine.
Yes.
Making so many people sit around because they no longer have a need for work.
Right.
So you turn right around and use another example of technology that expressed the refrigerator has created more jobs than what it originally displaced. Because now we need people to produce electricity, people to produce freon, people to produce universe. We need to mention the fact that products create the need of other products which create the need of themselves because it becomes a vicious cycle.
It's clearly true that some of the machines do create jobs. If creating jobs is a good thing, then definitely, obviously, industrial technology creates a lot of jobs as well as jobs that it destroys or suppresses. But the thing is, the what you lose in the process is this, that so long as each man was on his own farm, each man took his own decisions. Is it going to rain tomorrow? John says yes and Bill says no. John therefore doesn't plant and Bill does. One of them is right and one of them is wrong. You take your own decisions and you take the consequence of your own decisions. You mature. You're subject to the discipline of the weather, which you can't control. But if you live in the big manufacturing, the industrial technological system, one, you lose... You're not nearly so directly in contact with the risk consequences of your own decisions. Firstly, you haven't got so many decisions to take, as if you're running your own farm. You can only decide whether to go to work or not. If you decide to go to work, you have to punch the clock and then do exactly what you get the Friday paycheck for doing. And you stand at that boom, 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 like a zombie doing some boom, 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 boom work all day long. You punch out at 1 o'clock, you punch back at 2 o'clock, you punch out at 6 o'clock, you commute home like a zombie, you flop down in with a can of beer and slippers in front of a TV set, and you watch zombie programs until you're too exhausted to do anything except go to bed. This is modern life. It's a whole system which locks you in and takes away your humanity.
It's only one small fraction of some of that system. It's not all of it. Not everybody is on that assembly line that you described.
Everybody is on something like it today. Most people are on something like it. Most jobs are, in that sense, or many jobs are, in that sense, meaningless. And he argues that you know, these technological jobs... I mean, it's true that in modern factories, they are trying to get round there. They're trying to recreate sort of initiative and responsibility and human contact. They have offices in which, you know, now it's only cubicles so that all the girls can gossip with one another, which is all they want to do all day long anyway. And that is human. The girls gossiping with one another, that is human. And you, by knocking down the walls and letting the girls sit, that's a restoration of humanity. I mean, human nature keeps coming back. But the system in itself is taking a terrible toll on humanness. It's dehumanizing.
It is, but what is really divine? We're going back and we're blaming the media for the result. We're not going back and picking the original cause.
Oh, the basic problem is sin. I mean, let's always remember that. If these tools could be wisely used, if they could be wisely used. But what we're saying is that then there'd be nothing wrong. But what we're saying is and what he's arguing, he's got a real case that has to be answered. What he's arguing is that the scale of technology today is so interlocking and allows for so little freedom of initiative. Because if I don't drive my truck to get the shoes away from Cleveland down to the retailer is out of business and the factory clogs up with shoes. Everybody has to do his thing. Everybody interlocks in a way that never used to happen. In the old days, the very most that interlocked was, let's say, a village, because all you needed was a cobbler, a baker, a few farmers, a soldier maybe, and on a small, everybody knew everybody else. Everybody knew everybody else's business. You couldn't get away with, all the old women were watching who was going out with who, and watching what they were doing all day long, and they knew, and you couldn't get away with it. Now you drive all over the place, and you've got motel, I mean, you know, it's, there's a heavy price to be paid for modern technology. Yes.
I think it's also wrong to say that more jobs are created than are lost in the country. And there's absolutely no doubt today that the system does not create enough jobs. There are over 30 million unemployed today in the Western world. In America, if you have 20 hours minimum wage jobs, you're no longer counted as unemployed. I mean, the whole statistic is troubling. The situation is the whole Western world absolutely desperate, and I don't want to talk about the others. And when it comes to the whole human factor, no wonder, because Adam Smith, whom we mentioned before, started as a concept to make his analysis. He saw what he called the homo economicus, the man who he will conserve for his purpose only from the point of view of his economic instincts.
Yes.
And all the rest has been forgotten ever since.
Yes.
And this is the problem at the price we pay. We have boxed ourselves in a position which we hardly can come out unless we really say we want to put first the problem, how should we as human beings live together and make a living?
Well,
and then we should use the riches of our economy and our political will to create a society. Otherwise,
that's right.
From the 18th century onwards, man became primarily an economic animal. That was capitalism. And the other, you're leaving out politics and especially leaving out religion. You're forgetting God. And people have steadily turned their backs on God. And they've created a materialistic society, a godless and materialistic society, which is posing incredible problems. If men turn back to God, could they wisely and happily administer the great industrial technological machine? David.
For me the correct point you just made.
Please.
I don't think they forgot religion. I think religion merged with economics. And that's why you can't fix it now. Because economics and religion are so intimately tied, and it's not the Catholic religion that it's tied into.
Yeah, of course.
In other words, what you're saying, economics have become a substitute religion. Just like communism is a substitute religion. And for other people, politics is a substitute religion. That I think is true. And because it's a substitute religion, because people think that sanctification is by earning money, that's capitalism. Because people think that sanctification is by earning money, you then talk to them about sanctification by prayer and they just don't understand. They can't take it seriously. They're switched on to the substitute and it's very difficult to pull them back to the real thing.
So you intend to destroy the technology so that capitalism will go away?
No, because as we've said before, if you took a sledgehammer to all of the machines without taking the machines out of people's hearts, without taking the sin out of people's hearts, without taking the godlessness out of people's hearts, they'd simply rebuild all the machines, because they believe in the machines as the answer to the life's problems, right?
The golden calf.
The golden calf, yes.
Only that's the owners of the machines do believe that.
It's not, it's the golden calf which sort of has all kinds of mechanical motions, you, with doodads and gimzos and, you know, it's the technological, it's, technology is a golden calf. Technology is an idol. It's a false idol. The serious question is, and I'm sure I know the Unabomber's answer, but that's not necessarily the true answer. Could industrial, if all men became Catholics again, how much would still survive of the great industrial technological machine?
All of it.
Tony, what do you say?
I was out of the technological business, the advancing of computers and things like that. When my wife had cancer, I just sort of dropped all those things.
Yes.
2 years later, I got back into it. 18 months, 2 years later, it had gone right by me. I decided, I made a conscious decision, I wasn't going to get involved in it.
Yes.
I don't have a fax machine. I wasn't going to get a cell phone that I could carry around with me. Everybody that I deal with has one.
Yes.
And I see them doing less, actually, with more, and they're not going ahead.
Yeah.
I've watched this, and I've made a conscious decision I'm not going to carry it.
Yeah.
I'm still going to do it the way I was doing it before. It went right by me.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happened. But in the 18 months to 2 years, that I was following,
yeah,
I was keeping up with what's new in computers,
yeah,
and making sure, et cetera. I have no idea
what's
going on.
See,
I don't believe that.
There's a point here that these machines, and he talks about, you know, the pocket phone going with you everywhere, and the sort of that now you're going to have a pocket fax in a moment. You know, you get a printout on your wrist.
I also am very much involved in the technology. Oh. You don't have that same phone and get just as much done.
Well,
just because I believe in technology doesn't mean I have a fax phone.
Well, what I was going to say is that. These machines, which are becoming more and more all-surrounding, are they compatible with a spiritual life?
I say no.
Well, that's experience speaking.
Maybe for others it's different.
See?
For me, it doesn't fit, because I have to gear myself up to keep up.
Yes.
That means I have to do more, and there's only one of me doing it.
Yeah.
And I can't keep up with it.
Keeping a factory open 24 hours a day does not seem like it would sanctify your workplace.
Yes, that's right.
And we restore all things in Christ. Everybody in all aspects of their life have to sanctify whatever our duties are.
Yes.
And it's hard to do that in a Catholic CEO and a Catholic VP and a Catholic board and unspotted Catholics running the to run it 24 hours a day. I don't think you could keep unspotted.
Yeah.
Campus.
Yeah.
Who said you had to run 24 hours?
I think that's intrinsic to IT.
Yeah. Yeah. Running 24 hours a day, for instance, the steel ovens, is intrinsic to IT.
Your airline's running 24 hours a day. Everything runs with electricity and lighting.
Yeah.
And
there's all kinds of things.
Technology. We're talking about industrial technology and the beast and the machine.
Yeah.
Not about this particular advance or that particular advance.
See, if you're a Catholic, if you're going to put God first again, if the first commandment is going back to the top of the top 20, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy strength. In the number 2 slot is thou shalt not blaspheme. In the number 3 slot, folks, is that great old timer, thou shalt keep the Sabbath holy. Then for number 4 we have honor your mum and your dad. And those are the top 10 of the top, the first 10 of the top 20. If you're going to put that back, I think that rules out quite a lot of the technological way of life. I mean, a lot of modern life is incompatible with a spiritual life. For instance, a television set.
Absolutely.
A television set is in many ways difficult to combine with a spiritual life in the home. Doctor.
I see that in my profession, because technology has so encroached upon medicine,
yes,
that in suburban and urban practices, it's test results and CAT scans,
yes,
and
yes,
this thing and that thing. And the patient, it doesn't mean a damn thing.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't mean a thing. And
yes.
And medicine in the urban setting runs 24 hours a day.
Yes.
You get your 24-hour walk-in clinics, you get your 24-hour,
yes,
emergency rooms. You have the doctor who takes a call for the group that night, and nobody else, and it's a,
Yes.
It's an all-consuming, impersonal.
How is that compatible with the spiritual life? I think Catholics would, if men became Catholics again, there would be a severe break. All of industrial technology would go through the scanner to see if it's compatible with the spiritual life and with the first commandment or not.
One of the first things that would be medical insurance policy. You've got your Mason views and you've got your Catholic views.
Right.
So doesn't it also make sense to have your Mason technology and your Catholic technology?
Well,
why can't technology run only 8 hours a day? And not work on Sunday.
What we're saying is that the Catholics would slow down. They would take a long, hard look at each piece of technology, and some of those pieces of technology, maybe many, would be ruled out as being incompatible with the spiritual life and with the love of God.
It wouldn't be the same, but I can't see
that. I'm surely we're not saying that all technology would be ruled out.
Wouldn't it be a bit like you said before that it was the Catholic Church that really eliminated Roman slavery over several hundred years gradually?
Yes.
And this approach today, if Catholicism could take over, would probably also take a fairly long time if we wanted to accomplish it without too much disruption.
I don't think the comparison quite applies, because technology is too all-engrossing. It's as the Unabomber says, technology, he says, it can't be destroyed piecemeal. It can't be destroyed piecemeal. If the industrial technology kept going, if it could keep going and if it kept going, and if at the same time, this is sheer speculation, men slowly turn back to Catholicism, then no doubt the Catholicism would eventually, dissolve and slow down and modify and change the technology or get the technology under control, which it isn't at the moment. But I don't think it would take as long as it took with slavery. The world is now, thanks to technology, the world is spinning at such a speed and at such an accelerating speed that there's no question of something happening over centuries. Surely we are in a situation which, we're spinning towards a crash at the moment. Because many people in modern society say that the machine is getting out of control and the forces that brought it to where it is are pushing it further and faster along in the same direction. But that doesn't mean to say that it can survive in that direction. And it's surely spinning towards a crash. Jim?
I find the similarity between the Unabomber's remarks here and Eisenhower's farewell speech in 1960, remarkable.
That's interesting.
The military industrial complex is exactly what this guy is talking about.
Yes.
I don't know.
I mean, I have the impression that I don't think General Eisenhower or President Eisenhower was questioning the very roots of modern society. He was questioning the military. He was questioning excessive military expense, and he was questioning that the military-industrial complex wagging the dog of the rest of the society. But I don't think he was questioning the very roots of society, which is what the Unabomber, the very roots of modern society. Eisenhower surely accepted the roots of modern society, like, the Wright, Nixon, and Kennedy, and I mean, they're all agreed that modern society is basically a wonderful thing.
I'm sure it's anyone to say that the military complex and the industrial technology or the...
Yes. I think the Unabomber is going much deeper than Eisenhower.
I agree with that.
I think it's not much worse than Eisenhower.
No, I suspect.
Do you see now, Tony, what the Unabomber is after?
Yeah, no, I understand. That makes sense.
And what do you think?
I saw my own situation in this.
Yes.
I see what he was saying, and I see how the business that I'm in has advanced so much, and the clients that I have are carrying these little phones, and they're on the phone while you're eating lunch with them. And when they want something, they want it now, or they want it yesterday. I don't have a fax machine, but I need to get it to them because they have to make a decision. increase is just unbelievable.
Yes.
And it's not stopping. I mean, it's going on.
Yes.
There's just a continuation. Whether it can be, like he says, brought into a Catholic world or Catholic spectrum, I don't know. I don't think so.
It's the
impossible, but I personally don't think so.
It reminds me of
The Sorcerer's Apprentice in the film Fantasia. Do anybody remember The Sorcerer's Apprentice? The Sorcerer's Apprentice gets hold of one of his master's formulas, and the sorcerer is told to wash out the basement while the master is away. So the sorcerer doesn't want to do all the work, so he uses one of the spells to get a bucket, a mop and a bucket to do the job by themselves. But the trouble is that the spell makes the mop and the bucket turn into two mops and buckets. Well, the job begins to get done even faster. That's grand. But then they turn into four. And then, you know, there are four buckets of water being sloshed in the floor of the basement, and four mops, and then there are eight, and then there are 16, and the thing turns into absolute chaos. And the situation is only saved when the original sorcerer comes back, and the apprentice is by now in complete panic, but the sorcerer comes back and uses the counter spell, and the whole thing returns to order. And of course the apprentice, the sorcerer, spanks the apprentice's bottom. But the modern man has built up something which is now spinning out of control. And this, it's that man has lost what it's all about. He's lost his humanness, he's lost his God. And when you lose your God, when you turn your back on God, what's left? There's nothing left but chaos.
Technology creates power, correct?
Yes.
And absolute power absolutely corrupts.
Yes.
So, because power corrupts, we should blame technology. If we turn ourselves back to Christ, the power will control us. Technology will go on.
Well, but for instance, we were saying, you know, there's technology which is incompatible with the spiritual life. The technology is so engrossing and so demanding and so time consuming and so all present.
Because we allow it to be that.
But if you've got a pocket phone, can it be anything other than capable of interrupting you at any time of day and night?
That's why they make a switch on to turn it off. We choose not to turn it off.
Yes, but if you still kept, why carry it around in the first place? You know, what's the use of having a carry phone which you don't turn on?
Well,
you know,
not the only time you make use of a phone.
It is a question of trade-offs, but the technology as a whole is too engrossing.
Didn't the Novus Ordo Church kind of excuse that people are injured? Didn't they say to go along with this technology? Isn't that one of their excuses for the invention of the Saturday night mass?
Yes.
Satisfied Sunday? I mean, a few of them took advantage to get it over with, but others, because we have to work in the whole complex of the world, the hub of the world.
Yes.
Created it, put the demand there, and they fulfilled it.
The Novus Ordo was definitely came in, partly because of the new world created by technology. And the old religion just doesn't seem to fit the new world. And therefore the religion had to be changed to fit this new world. And that's why the new world, the new religion, suggests Malachi Martin here, is heavy into the technology and everything else. Because the new world is the new religion's business. It's not, the question of machines is not the primary question, but the importance of machines in so many people's minds today is a measure of their decadence. Because the main problem and the main solution is never by machines. The main problem and the main solutions are always in men's hearts. Solzhenitsyn once said, the dividing line between good men and bad men doesn't go between one nation and another nation. It doesn't go between this part of the nation and that part of the nation. It doesn't go between this party and that party. It doesn't go between this village and that village. It doesn't go between this family and that family. The dividing line between good and evil, Solzhenitsyn says, goes between this part of my heart and that part of my heart. Good and evil is rooted in both. In the clash between good and evil takes place inside every one of us, and that's where it has to be fought. So it's a question of the human heart and good and evil in the human heart, and that's not a question that machines can get anywhere near. The Catholic Church doesn't operate by machines, and it doesn't need machines. It does not need machines. And it can use machines as long as they're kept in their place, but it doesn't need them. What it does need is confession and preaching and the sacraments. But confession is one-on-one, and you can't do it. Even confession by telephone is invalid. It's one man talking to another. You can talk out in the middle. You can go to confession out in the middle of the field, walking through the wilds. You don't stole it, but what you do have to have is one man listening to another, or one human being listening to another, one man listening to another human being. That you have to have. Similarly, preaching. It doesn't need machines, but it does need the contact, the direct contact between man and men, between a preacher and a human audience. And that direct contact is a two-way traffic. There's nothing mechanical about it. When our Lord converts, when our Lord preaches, or he absolves, but again, it's always man on man. It's never with any kind of machine intervening. The machines can be useful, but they can't do anything that's essential. Whereas modern man has been brought to the point where he thinks that problems are to be conceived in mechanical terms and they're to be solved by mechanical solutions. Invent a new machine. Discover a new drug. You can't, that can't do it. And humans today are dehumanized. Human beings today are losing their understanding of what a human being is and how a human being works. What makes a human being tick? And that's why the new education includes so little of the old literature. The old literature, Shakespeare and so on, makes no sense in the new world. And the teachers that have to teach Shakespeare don't believe in it. And therefore the kids don't believe in it. And therefore they're all more or less persuaded that Shakespeare is actually a complete waste of time. What they all want to get onto is biology, technology, computers, sociology perhaps. They're all misunderstanding and mistaking human nature. And therefore human beings are getting less and less human. And therefore the youngsters are more and more alienated without their having any idea why or where it's coming from. And they don't know how to try to solve it. They've got no handle on the problem, let alone on the, and therefore they've got even less of a handle on any solution. It's an incredible situation. And it's being created by the Freemasons who wanted to completely change human nature.
And they're taking advantage of technology.
They're spinning the thing. They're taking advantage of technology. But the main problem isn't technology. The misuse of technology is the expression of the problem rather than the root of the problem. The root of the problem is men turning away from God. And therefore the root of the solution is turning back to God. And if men would turn back to God, technology would eventually drop back into its proper place, which is a very useful place.
And because to give truth a place, we have just two criteria. It's extortion and make-believe. If I should summarize this word today, it's extortion and make-believe.
Lies, whichever way you look at it. Any other questions on anything that came up today? David?
I'd just like to get your... We were talking earlier about the French Revolution.
Yes.
You mentioned the British were on the side of the angels against Napoleon.
By accident.
And I just wanted to see your ideas on the statement Belloc had made. That if Napoleon had won,
yes,
that he's beaten Lutheran Prussia, Orthodox Russia, Anglican Britain.
Yeah.
In spite of his own intentions, he would have spread Catholic culture.
Napoleon.
He wouldn't have wanted to, but the fact that the French won.
Yeah, I understand. That's an interesting point. I'm afraid I'm not an expert in that period of history.
I think so.
The It's, that's one of those, what would history have been like if Cleopatra's nose had been half an inch longer, you know? It's a very difficult, there's one of those what ifs in history. What if Napoleon had defeated, had won? What if Hitler had won? It's very difficult to gauge. I don't know what the Lord God would have done. I mean, the Lord God might have converted Napoleon then, or, but generally, we were definitely on the process of history is at that point on the downswing. So would Catholicism have prevailed? I don't think so. Napoleon's ideas were essentially revolutionary. If Napoleon is responsible for having spread revolution throughout Europe. Napoleon was the carrier and the success maker of the revolution. The revolution was grinding into a halt. It was grinding itself to pieces. The Directory in France in 1794. The one who really made the revolution take off and spread all over Europe was Napoleon. So I don't think you can say that those French soldiers of Napoleon carried Catholicism. Or that they would, if he'd won everywhere, they would have carried Catholicism. I think the French Revolution would have spread farther faster than it did. Because the Napoleon's soldiers carried the revolution in their baggage. They all were singing the Marseillaise, you know, they all went to war singing the Marseillaise and glorying in the wonders of revolutionary France. It wasn't Catholic France that they were carrying with them. Somebody says that, like Vatican II, some people say that, Vatican II was like the French Revolution. The French Revolution was like Vatican II. And just as it's Napoleon who really made the revolution succeed and who really spread the revolution everywhere because he organized it and controlled it and licked it into shape, whereas by itself the revolution was chaos. Read again the excellent book of Carrot. Napoleon was the one who pulled the revolution together and made it succeed. Same thing you might say Paul VI, or some people would say John Paul II was the one that let's say John Paul II. John Paul II is probably a better comparison. John Paul II. Napoleon was an apparent conservative who apparently controlled the French Revolution and slowed down its excesses. But in fact, he was the one that really spread the revolution everywhere. Similarly, John Paul II apparently slowed down, apparently he's conservative, apparently he's sort of slowing down some of the wilder excesses of Vatican II, but he's actually the one that's making Vatican II succeed everywhere. So John Paul II is the Napoleon of Vatican II. So I think it's difficult to argue that if Napoleon had won all his wars, the French would have spread Catholicism. Those soldiers were not Catholic. They didn't have a Catholic spirit.
They were a mixture.
Well, some of them...
A lot of those peasants loved Napoleon to death because of the Concordat War, because of the
rapprochement. Yes. Well, I don't know enough about the period, but I think, and undoubtedly many of his soldiers were individually Catholic, yes. But the whole spirit and thrust, from the Battle of Valmy onwards, the whole spirit and thrust of Napoleon's campaign was the toppling of the old regime, the defeating of the armies of these other countries, and the establishing of revolutionary ideas. You read, for instance, Tolstoy's War and Peace, and he has the French soldiers in burning Moscow talking to, you know, the Russians there and so on, and the French soldiers, they bring in the revolutionary ideas. We're a new world, my dear friends. You must love us French. We're great guys, and we've got a new message and a new gospel to bring you. That's his kind of message. I'm sure that's the spirit that carried those French armies to victory everywhere. Napoleon was not a godly man, not by any manner of speaking.
How long before he died?
I think he died with the priest. I mean, I think he died as a Catholic. I think, yes. There was a priest on Elba. Where was he at finding exile? St. Helena. There was a priest on St. Helena. I do believe he died with the sacraments, yes.
I think France has only been liberal in its intellectual class And the solid middle class and the peasantry was very, very conservative and Catholic.
Middle class from Huguenots.
No, the middle, the what performed the French Revolution was the middle class. It was the Jansenist lawyers and the bourgeois that reacted with the help of a few treacherous aristocrats. That's what overthrew the rest of the good, the aristocrats and the king. It was the middle class revolution, the French Revolution, essentially. I think so. And as for the workers, well, you know, a lot of them were rejoicing at watching all of the heads being cut off. A number of the workers were good, but a lot of them were also bad. I think you can say. And the overriding, the driving spirit of Napoleon's armies was rather revolutionary, I'm sure. We're very close. For tomorrow, take a look at, begin reading Libertas. Read to about paragraph, some of this is a bit tricky. Hold on. Read to about 20.